And I think authenticity is a quite undervalued thing in this current society when everybody's trying to make themselves look fabulous on Instagram and trying to put out this persona. But authenticity is what attracts people, because people like to be safe and secure, and if you're authentic, they know what you get. For me, it's been a long journey to be authentic and to become confident enough to be authentic. I think it's very important that people do think about authenticity, and I think there's a lot going on in this world with artificial intelligence, deep fakes, that authenticity is such an amazing skill, characteristic, or virtue that you can have.
I think authenticity, right, comes from not just being self-aware, but also being very confident in who you are and what you are. Because we are not everything to all people. Like, that person doesn't exist.
And now I've got sucked in, I think is the right word. No, I'm being encouraged to get involved in the Apple industry and to look after his legacy, but also to look after the people that have continually, that took the risk to plant the Pink Lady Apple, and the people that have continually grown it and have been loyal to that apple variety.
In this episode, I have the pleasure of chatting with Helen Cripps. Helen is part of the founding family that discovered the world-famous Pink Lady Apples. Also known as Cripps Pink Apples, Pink Lady Apples is one of the most popular apple varieties in Australia and globally, with hundreds of thousands of tons grown every year. During our conversation, she shares intimate details of how Pink Lady Apples came to be, the joys and struggles of being part of an iconic family business legacy, and how she now empowers future entrepreneurs in her career as a university lecturer. Without further ado, please enjoy this episode of The Way with Cheech Fu, featuring Helen Cripps. Welcome, Helen.
Hi, Cheech.
How are ya?
I am fabulous.
Well, I mean, I will say definitely so, because look at the color on you, Helen.
I love pink. And you'll find out why when we get into this podcast.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. I look forward to it. Thank you again for coming out, right? Really appreciate it. We've known each other for a very long time now, haven't we? Yeah. So take me back, actually. When is the first time that we actually met and caught up? Do you remember? Yeah.
I remember my manager at work saying, oh, we've had this gentleman, Cheech, that wants to come in and help our students learn about digital marketing. I thought, who on earth is he? And then eventually I got to meet you and I worked out why you wanted to help our students and why you were so passionate about being part of the higher education system. Because at that stage, I think it was over 10 years ago, I think it was 2014. So there was not a lot about digital marketing. I was trying to teach digital marketing, but I didn't come from a digital marketing background. So any expertise we could get in a benefit. And Edith Cowan University is very keen on having their students have practical experience as well. There's no point in having a head of just a theory is good, but you need to be able to give something to your company when you are first employed. You need to have skills and expertise that you can apply in a workplace setting. And that was something that was very core to Edith Cowan and very core to my own teaching principles, that I wanted to fit students for the workforce.
Yes, yes. And I do believe last time, The very first time I met you and I had that opportunity, very gracious, of course, by you, Helen, right, to invite someone who's never really done much guest speaking at that time before, right, to come in and actually have a chat to your students. And one thing I did actually notice and have continuously noticed throughout the years that we've collaborated together was that you seem to have a very unique style of engaging with students. And I say that with the most of compliments, because it feels very dynamic, right? It feels very engaging, right? I feel that, you know, the students, probably because they're vibing off you, right? They all actually want to be there to actually learn something. They're not just there to tick a box, so to speak. So, I mean, yeah, come speak to me a little bit more about that. That's really interesting.
So I've developed a teaching kind of philosophy around the fact that I wanted to enable and empower young people. I really want to fight on their side. I did a PhD so I could become a lecturer at university, because I really wanted to give other people the opportunity to learn and to support young people in that learning endeavour. I came from a very fortunate background and I had a lot of support from my family, but not all young people, when they rock up at university, have this necessarily the support or the framework to be successful at university. So therefore, I see teaching as a privilege that I can be part of these young people's journey and I can give them opportunities such as work placement, work experience. I can bring experts in that are more expert than I am, but then I facilitate that process. And I really wanted them to walk away from my units knowing that they've learned something and they've developed skills that are going to make them more marketable in the working environment in Perth or wherever they end up. Some of them ended up all over the world. So that's really, really important. And you've been one of my, you know, ongoing guest speakers. You've come and spoke most semesters in my class and you've spoken in other people's classes as well. You know, you're someone that also communicates really well with young people and they identify with that. And you're very honest and I find that's very helpful. Young people, everybody can, but young people are particularly have a good radar for people that are pretending to be something that they're not. And I think authenticity is a quite undervalued thing in this current society when everybody's trying to make themselves look fabulous on Instagram and trying to put out this persona. But authenticity is what attracts people because people like to be safe and secure, and if you're authentic, they know what you get. For me, it's been a long journey to be authentic and to become confident enough to be authentic. I think it's very important that people do think about authenticity, and I think there's a lot going on in this world with artificial intelligence, deep fakes, that authenticity is such an amazing skill, characteristic or virtue that you can have.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Helen, I am still waiting for that $25,000 a deal influencer for someone to send me to Maldives for $10,000 a night. So that aside, absolutely. I think authenticity, right, comes from not just being self-aware, but also being very confident in who you are and what you are. Because, you know, we are not everything to all people. Like, that person doesn't exist, right?
Correct.
So as long as you're comfortable in what you are and you know what you're good at and you know what you're there to do, right, and how you can contribute, right, everything else is just...
But I think knowing what you're good at is for me has been a really, really long journey in my life. And I think that's part of teaching is giving students abilities, opportunities to learn and learn and fail, but not fail the unit and not fail the assessments, but to continually iteratively learn within the classroom.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't know what they're good at. A lot of people don't know what they want to do as a job. So it's about giving them exposure to as much as possible so that they can try and find where their strengths are. And what I was good at, say, 20 years ago is quite different to what I'm good at now. And we might talk about it later. We can talk about it now. But, you know, I'm getting involved in my father's legacy because he bred the Pink Lady Apple.
Yes.
And now I've got sucked in, I think is the right word. No, I'm being encouraged to get involved in the apple industry and to look after his legacy, but also to look after the people that have continually, that took the risk to plant the Pink Lady Apple and the people that have continually grown it and have been loyal to that apple variety. And as part of that, I'm trying to set up an Apple Heritage and Produce Trail so people can learn about apple growing, the apple industry, the history. We have four quite famous apples that come from Western Australia. We have Lady Williams, and then we have Pink Lady, Sundowner, and Bravo. And the Lady Williams was used as one of the apples in the cross to make the Pink Lady because it was Lady Williams and Golden Delicious. So, we have this great heritage of breeding apples, of creating innovation and innovation in apples. And Pink Lady was an innovation in itself because they chose to trademark the name. That's the trademark is Pink Lady. The apple's called Cripps Pink. So that being able to trademark the name and to market under a trademark and to make that brand promise, the huge risk, because if you knew how hard it is to get consistent apples into the supermarket, but they made that. And that trademark and that brand is internationally recognised now.
Okay.
But it was a long, slow process. And I think sometimes when we talk about innovation, we think you raise money, you grow a company reasonably quickly. But when you're dealing with products and things like apples, fruits and things like that, and getting something new is really, really hard and takes lots of work.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people look at entrepreneurs and think, oh, look, you've been successful really quickly, but it's not that quick. I mean, Amazon's been around since the 1990s, so, you know, it hasn't been that quicker transformation. Even Meta's been around since the 1990s, I believe. So that people say, oh, it's an overnight success, but it's not an overnight success.
No,
and,
no.
And if you look at, if you are looking at being an entrepreneur or being entrepreneurial, you have to look at what other people have done and look at their life stories and see how they've overcome difficulties and problems. And, you know, it wasn't easy for my dad to do that breeding. He had to spend a lot of time away from our family to go down to to Manjimup up to breed the apples.
From Perth? Yeah, is that correct?
Yeah, so I grew up in Perth, but the breeding program moved from Stoneville down to Manjimup. And so my father spent he would leave on Monday morning, come back Friday night from Manjimup to work on the breeding program.
Yeah.
And my mother was a very capable woman and she ran the household. And I'd be so excited every time that Dad went away because it meant we could have fast food and we could watch anything other than the ABC TV, which was what was enforced in our household. But anyway.
Was it KFC or McDonald's?
It was Red Rooster back then.
Ooh.
Or Fish and Chips was fish one. Chips. That was something very special. But I digress. I think it's really important. If I was going to talk to young people or people that are trying to find their passion,
yes,
is that you try and get exposed to as many things as possible. And
yes,
for me, being exposed to the apple industry has been a complete revelation. And although I'm 60 this year and I have a PhD and I have a very successful academic career, being immersed in the apple industry has been humbling, overwhelming, and it oftentimes quite challenging because it's not a subject area that, even though my dad did the breeding, it was not an area that I'm not a horticulturist, I'm not an agricultural scientist. So it's like having to learn a whole new area. So, but this to be successful learning a new area, you find good people that are willing to answer your questions. And I think questions are, if you're going to talk about what's my way, asking questions I think is one of the most powerful things you can do. And people, you know what you know, but you don't know what other people know till you ask them. And I think that's really important. And I think that's particularly for anybody that's trying to build a business, trying to find their path in life or what they're good at or being an entrepreneur, is asking questions. And people are quite happy to talk about themselves. It might be a surprise to some people, but people really like talking about themselves. So if you ask them questions, then you will learn about them. And if you are looking for something, you're looking for opportunity or funding or for a collaborator or whatever you're looking for, if you say, oh, could you help me? And if they say, no, I can't help you, so do you know anybody else that can help me?
Yes.
And that second ask is always really, really important because people might know someone in their network. And if they like you and you come across as authentic, then they will actually then refer you on. And so many times I've referred my students on or I've given people leads. Last week you met one of my friends that was visiting in Perth, and that was like a what we call like a warm referral.
Absolutely.
And you met him and now believe that there might be you might be working together on a project. So
absolutely.
And I think that's a really good thing as well as if you're going to, I'm very much an introducer and I'm very much into trying to connect people. And I think if you look at doing good for others and you look at connecting them, you look at supporting them, you look at giving them opportunities, that always comes back.
Yeah.
Because you'll attract people that are like you, that people have the same values, and they're the people that are going to help lift you up if you help lift them up and if you actually help them as well. So there's a lot of takers in this world. Was it takers, matchers and givers? But, you know,
yes,
if you can learn to give a bit, then that often it will come back to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't disagree, Helen. I think giving is a really big part of a successful journey in life. And there's always someone, right, that can benefit from your learnings. And there's always someone that you can learn from as well.
And you're an example of that because you'll give up your time when I know that, you know, you're running your own business, but you'll still come and talk to my students and in order to build them up, you know, and to give them new insights. And that is so valuable.
Absolutely. Now, before I go on, I know that right now you have a lot of different initiatives connected to the Pink Lady Apples and some other things that you're working on. But I do want to kind of really give it the credit that it has, right? So for me, Pink Lady Apples, before I met you, right, I've known about it my whole life. You know, when I walk into the supermarkets, right, one of my Coles and my local Woolies, right, I've always seen it there. I was like, Pink Lady, oh, that's great. Had no idea where it was from, who started it, any of the background. So when I found out that it was actually you and your family, right, that played the biggest part in bringing this to life, this Pink Lady, it was amazing. Such a special one. So I want to kind of, if you're willing to, I would love to kind of start from the beginning and ask, like, you know, since, from what age did you realize that there was something special about your family? Like, that's where I really want to start, Helen.
Well, it really is my father's journey, but I do remember as a, I think I would have been about a 10-year-old. So my father decided, he emigrated from England after the Second World War because things were pretty dire there. Mm. And he got offered a job at the Agricultural Department of Western Australia. So he was a 10-pound POM and he got on a boat. And then he actually sat on down in Fremantle for an hour on a very hot afternoon waiting for someone to come pick him up. Because, folks, there was a time before mobile phones. So he didn't have anybody to ring. He couldn't WhatsApp to say, and he couldn't call himself an Uber.
Yep.
So, and it all was done by phone. So he turned up in Western Australia and he worked on a number of different projects, but he decided that he really liked to try and invent an apple that would revolutionise the apple industry and actually provide really good returns for apple growers. When he grew up in England, the apples in England tend to be hard and small. He thought he could do better. So he went to his boss and said, I want to start an apple breeding program. And his boss said, well, no, you can't. And he said, can I start an apple breeding program? And his boss said, no, you can't. And then eventually his boss said, yes, you can, as long as it doesn't detract from your other research work, because he was a research scientist. So my dad did it as part of his job, and he used the Stoneville Research Station. So he used the Agricultural Department's resources. He had a number of women that worked with him because during the cross-pollination was a very dexterous endeavour, so he had a number of really good research officers he worked with, and he always praised and acknowledged them. So the first cross was done in 73 with the first apples produced from 100,000 crosses appearing in 74. Now, of those 100,000, you know, flowers that got pollinated, only one third didn't actually produce any fruit. One third produced fruit that was inedible, and then one third produced fruit that had potential. And so then when it went on for another probably about 15 years where they crossed and crossed and crossed, and out of those, that continual cross-pollinating, but also getting the apples to fruit. So when the apple fruited, you had to, my sister and I had to eat them, give a rating and spit the pips out. And Dad would take the pips, plant them and create seedlings, and then those seedlings would be grafted. So it wasn't like, it's not like software where you can get it updated, you know, you can update within 24, 48 hours. This was a year-by-year cycle of actually producing the right apple. And Dad bred the apple for particular purposes, and one was at the balance between sweet and tart. He wanted the pink skin colour. He also wanted an apple that stored well, and he wanted an apple that he could actually export from Western Australia to help the growers. And for many, many years after the Pink Lady was launched, it was exported to England, but that factors, including cost of labour, actually slowed down the growers' ability to export, and we stopped exporting quite a few years ago, which is quite sad.
So right now, as of right now, there are no Pink Lady apples to England?
No, they're not anymore. Yeah. They actually come from France or from South Africa or from Chile or from New Zealand. So there's a whole Pink Lady, International Pink Lady Alliance, and the apples are moved around. So we only have one season of Pink Ladies in Western Australia, and that's the ones that are picked in April, May, and then they're put in cold store. So the one that's actually on the desk next to me is probably was picked in May last year. But because Dad bred with specific intentions, Pink Ladies survive in cold storage for up to a year. And that was his intention. So that meant that the farmers, the orchardists, could get income over a year. It means that we're quite spoilt in Western Australia because we don't understand that apples are actually seasonal. Because I was looking for a Bravo, which is one of Dad's other apples, and I couldn't find any of them because it was like 11 months ago that the Bravos were put in cold storage. Pink Ladies tend to last a lot longer, which is good. But, you know, sometimes you've got to realise if you're buying a Pink Lady in March, you might be buying last year's Pink Lady that's come out of storage.
So it could be up to like, what, 12 months?
Up to 12 months,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But he was really keen to have an apple that was popular and successful. And it was, and they released it to the Australian growers. So in Australia, it's not drawn, they didn't ever play plant variety rights, and they never, there's no trademark usually on the apple because they don't pay for the trademark either. Mm. Everybody overseas does, but because it was done as part of a research project funded by the government, Dad Sutter was funded, so was the research station, that was released to the growers so they could benefit from it.
And what year was that? The fact that it was developed?
It was officially developed. I think it was really launched around late 1980s, early 1990s. We've got a really cute video of Dad in Sainsbury's in England in 1992 when they were doing a piece for TV about the fact that he was standing there launching these apples and people asking, oh, what do you think? Oh, the lady's, oh, lovely flavour, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so Dad's in the background.
Great.
And it was actually given, the video was actually sent to me by the chief research officer on the Maserat Research Station now who worked with Dad. And I said to him, it was lovely to see my father young, because my father died at 95 and, you know, I looked after him for the last few years of his life. And my memories of him are predominantly of him as being quite old or very old, because, you know, 95 is a reasonably good...
That's a great tenure.
Well, see, you know, you have an apple a day, that's what happens. You know, that's our joke.
I love it.
And his last meal was stewed Pink Lady apples, so they were very happy about that, the people that took care of him. But, you know, it's nice to see him young, and it's nice to see... And to remember back to that time, it's been... It's been good to do the work with the industry, but it's also been quite sad because it does make me have to... I do miss my dad, but it's good to be... to have something to celebrate about him. And I enjoy that. And last year I went to Italy and met a whole bunch of people I'd never met before that grow Pink Ladies in the north of Italy and around Bolzano. And then I went to France and met the two brothers that are involved, and their father actually came to Perth to pick up the budwood to grow Pink Ladies in France. And I've met one of the sons, but I hadn't met the other ones. But I actually knew their father. So both their father and my father were friends. I went to England and found people growing Pink Ladies down in Kent, which was really good. I think Dad would be very happy that finally the English get to grow really nice apples. So, yeah, it's been a great experience. And I've chosen to embrace that experience. I have a sister and she's involved as well. We're working on the Donnybrook Apple Festival at the moment.
Yep.
And working on promoting apples through that festival.
Okay, well, fantastic. Now, before I go on, if you can just hold up the apple and show everyone right on the video. So this is the model of a Pink Lady apple. What is it? Is it 12-month matured? Like, what stage is this one at?
So this would be last year's.
Okay.
Because I know they haven't started picking the... So the Pink Ladies are unusual. So they're very popular, but the growers find them... They have to be left to ripen the tree for 200 days of sunlight. So they're the longest maturing apples. They're often the ones to be harvested latest in the season. So we're already harvesting apples now. So galas are coming in now.
Yep.
The Pink Ladies are like the Pink Ladies and actually Sundowners, which is another variety. They're quite late in the season. So they say, oh, my goodness, they're on the tree for 200 days. You know, we've got to look after them and, you know, make sure they're okay. And you've got to get them to colour up properly. So sometimes they use reflective film in the orchards on the ground to get them to colour all over.
Oh, so wait. How does that work? So explain that. That's a very interesting concept.
So if an apple hangs on a tree like this,
yes.
The sun comes from above, but you've got to get light to the below the apple to actually get it to colour. So people love the Pink Lady because of the colour of the skin. So to get it to colour up, you actually put down like... It's not alfoil, but it looks like alfoil on the bottom of the trees to reflect the light up to get the apple to colour.
Okay.
And while they're growing, they have to actually prune the trees because if you let the tree bear all the fruit, you get small apples. So they actually cull apples off the trees and remove leaves to get the light to the apple. Now, what's happening now is because we've had these really, really hot days,
yes,
some of the apples are getting sunburnt, unfortunately. So, and that's part of the things with the unpredictability of our climate at the moment,
yes,
is quite challenging for the apple industry or for the fruit growing or for any agricultural industry, is because, you know, we've had these really, really hot days that's affecting all sorts of produce. They now have shade, or they have nets over the top of the apples to stop the birds from eating them, but they're now using netting to try and shade the apples to stop them from getting sun damage, yes, because every apple that's sun damaged, it does not go to your supermarket, it goes into waste, or maybe it gets made into something like gin or cider. So all these byproducts of apples, so that's or into apple juice, but... in Western Australia, we have this very big company called Harvey Fresh, and Harvey Fresh don't make, yes, apple juice from locally grown apples. They make it from imported concentrate, which is really sad. So these are the things that happen in the produce market, and I think that's going back to being in business. You know, marketplaces don't behave the way that you expect they will. They don't all behave in a way that is logical or beneficial. So there's lumpiness in marketplaces. And so, so the Harvey Fresh have decided that it's not economically viable for them to use local apples from the producers, so they import concentrate. And that's been with the change of management, and the company was bought out. So these kind of things are happening in the industry. A lot of growers are talking about actually pulling out their apple trees because it's getting harder for them to make a profit. And... if your listeners are Australians, they might have seen the program on the supermarkets in Australia recently.
Yes, the price inquiry. Yes, is that the one you're referring to?
Price inquiry.
Yep. Yes.
And so there's a number of challenges for the apple industry and for growers. And sometimes when I was in Italy, the growers in Italy said their land is worth more for housing than it is for growing apples because it's such, they're in such a prime location that, you know, economically it would be better for them to pull out their trees and put houses up. But if that happens in Western Australia, if people start pulling out their apple trees, then we are going to get either apples from the eastern states or from New Zealand. And I can tell you if they've been... exported from another part of the of Australia or somewhere else, they won't be as fresh. And having eaten pink ladies all around the world, the pink ladies grown in West Australia are the best.
The best.
They are the best.
You heard it here, everyone.
Yes, I did. I my Finnish friend visiting, and I gave him a slice of local pink lady apple, and he said, "Yep, that's better than the European ones." But please, I hope this never makes it to Europe, because the growers there would be. But the pink lady was bred in Western Australia,
of course,
and it was bred for West Australian conditions, and that makes it challenging sometimes to grow it elsewhere. But it's a very, what would I say, not a finicky apple, but it has these things like it has to be grown for 200 days. So it's in one sense quite risky because it's on the tree longer for more weather, but it also is that premium product.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, like, you know, I would call it TLC, right? It requires a little bit of tender love and care, you know, to grow a very beautiful pink lady apple. And look, being authentic on this podcast, right? It is what it is, right? I think a lot of people are very surprised at how enterprising the agriculture industry in WA is, right? As an example, right? So apples are one thing, right? The other thing that a lot of people don't know about is the truffle industry.
That's right. We've developed quite a strong truffle industry. I mean, and
it's amazing.
We're producing lots of food products. That's one of the big focuses. I was at a seminar last week about food products up in Gingin.
Yes.
And that's what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop high-quality food products that are internationally competitive. The thing about Australia, and anybody in the entrepreneurial area will know that we have a small market here. You know, 26 million people is a relatively small market when you compare it to, say, somewhere like Europe or the USA, you know. So we have a small market, or Asia, which is a huge market. And it's on our doorstep. And we need to be focusing on developing premium and unique products. So one of the things I love about the gin in Western Australia is that often it's made with local botanicals. So you can't get some of the Cripps Pink Gin has got strawberry gum in it. That's a West Australian botanical.
Yes.
You can't get that in gin in Europe. So it is quite a novel idea. And we have competitive advantage. We have novel ingredients and products that we can sell. But sometimes the producer has a lot of problems finding the pathway to export and finding the right people to talk to. And I find this is one of the things I keep coming across in Western Australia is people don't know who to talk to and they don't know the next step along the line. So if we're going to talk about the way again, is my thing, and I've talked about it before, is actually asking questions but also helping other people out, referring them on, seeing, you know, the gin producers here in Western Australia don't compete, they collaborate because they see themselves as if they work together, they can grow their industry. And I think that's really, really important that we look at that. And you always, yes, you'll have people that are your direct competitors, but you need to differentiate yourself so you're not quite in competition. And sometimes you can collaborate and you can and do something bigger and something better by collaborating with other people. Pink Lady would not have been so internationally successful if the French hadn't got involved. They set up they set up the Pink Lady, International Pink Lady Alliance. They worked with Australian Apple Pear Alliance and they worked on enforcing the trademark. Unfortunately, they never got it in America, but Chile and Argentina have now taken the trademark for the Pink Lady apples. It's bred in, they're grown in South Africa, they're grown in Italy, France, England. So, but they've really driven the marketing forward, particularly the Pink Lady Europe. And if Dominique Toulamon hadn't convinced the board of his cooperatives that he could actually fly to Perth, Western Australia and go and knock on John Cripps's door at the agricultural department, Pink Lady probably would not have been as such a big brand. So
okay, so this Dominic individual played a big part.
Yes, so he convinced his cooperative to actually grow Pink Ladies and then he took the trademark and he started playing, they paid the plant variety rights. So for the last 25 years, there's been royalties on every single Pink Lady tree that was planted for commercial cropping. So that also provided money back into the research program down in Manjimup, and that's where the Bravo apple came from. And now the Bravo is going to be exported overseas because it's a, as a premium apple. So they're looking at trying to take back where the Australian Bravo producers are now trying to shore up export markets in Asia so that they can get additional revenue. So,
wow, that's really interesting. So following on from that, you did mention gin, right? And we were talking about earlier today the different initiatives that you have going on, et cetera, right? I can see that you actually did bring in something very interesting today, Helen. Would you like to share with the viewers on what this little beauty is?
Okay, so this is a bottle of Cripps Pink Gin. So remember I said Pink Lady apples are actually called Cripps Pink. So if you go and Google Pink Lady, it'll tell you it's Cripps Pink and you'll find pictures of John Cripps. But so the at the a place called The Cidery in Bridgetown, they've been making cider out of Pink Lady apples for like 20 years because that's where the main Pink Lady... And a lot of the cider in Western Australia, if it's made in Western Australia, it has some or all Pink Lady apples in it. It's very much... We do make cider from traditional cider apples, but mostly people have been making cider of the apples that were available, and that were Pink Ladies because they were the biggest brand.
Yep.
Anyway, so after my father passed away, I was curious to see what the conversation was about Pink Lady. And so I put, you know, hashtag Pink Lady, hashtag Cripps Pink into Instagram, and I found that there was Blackwood Valley Distillery that works out of the cidery in Bridgetown were making Cripps Pink. Now, the gentleman, Dave, who actually does the distilling, actually invented this before my father passed away. But unfortunately, I didn't know about it because I think Dad would have been, here we go, tickled pink that there was a gin made out of his apple. Because Pink Lady's named after a cocktail. So that now there's a Cripps Pink gin. So again, this is something I do as a voluntary basis, but I really it's really cool to be able to hand people a bottle of gin with your name on it, which is really great.
That is really cool.
That's really cool. Yes. I've taken suitcases of this. No. I've transported all around the world. I've given it to people to take home with them in their suitcase, but we're not exporting at the moment because it's only a small production gin.
Yes.
But again, this is a product that would have international appeal. But it's a matter of getting that scaffolding there. And this, again, is what I keep hitting these barriers or these things that have to get over to get things to be successful. And I've been talking to the state government about developing an initiative to maybe try and export gin internationally because we have unique botanicals. So if we were making a London Dry, which is a famous kind of gin, and that's all we made, and there was nothing different about a gin, why would we bother?
Yes.
You know, but Old Young's won an award at the London Gin Festival, and I spoke to somebody from Old Young's, and they said, it's a bit devastating when you win a gold medal, but you can't, nobody can buy your gin because we're not exporting out of Western Australia. And I went like, that is a problem that really needs to be solved.
So wait, Old Young is from WA?
It is from WA.
They are also unique botanicals?
Yes.
Okay. And they won this award.
It is a gold medal at the London Gin Awards?
London Gin Awards. Oh, I would say the most prestigious?
One of the most prestigious.
One of the most prestigious. Okay. Why is it that we can't export?
Yeah. Because we'd have to, we just don't have the supply network set up at the moment. And I was speaking to somebody up in the Swan Valley, and I've suggested, because we've been very successful with wine in this country. So again, this is another thing to think about as you're, if you're going to start a business or you're going to be an entrepreneur, or you go around and find out what other people have done. Now, the wine industry in Australia is a fabulous example of how it went from being considered the laughing stock to being now one of the biggest wine producers and exporters in the world. And they've developed a fun kind of tagline for Australian wine, but now it's considered quite seriously as well. Yellowtail's one of the ones, you know. But again, that was about people getting together and saying, how can we solve this problem? How can we get a bigger market? So that's something that, that may happen in the future. But the other thing is we pay incredibly high tax on alcohol in this country. We're number three in the world after Iceland and Norway.
Did not know that.
No, it's a very, very high alcohol tax. So every bottle of gin that we make here, there's a large proportion of the value goes in a tax on the alcohol and the gin. And the more alcohol you have, the more tax you pay on every bottle of gin. So,
understand.
So we'd have to work that out. But that's, it's not my job. It's just something that I'm interested in. But that's, again, gives me another area of interest. I'm very keen on the fact that there's not a lot of Pink Lady in that gin. But, you know, that there are other ways to use apples. There's other ways to use produce. There's a distillery in the Swan Valley that uses discarded fruit to make the original alcohol to go into the gin. So they're reusing stuff. So, again, a part of that circular economy. So there's all these different ideas that come in that you can see. If you look outside of what just your industry is, you can learn about different ways of doing business, and particularly even overseas. So the circular economy is very, very big overseas. And also about reusing, so wasting less and reusing more, and using waste products to make new products. And I think that's a really important thing to think about as well.
Yes.
Other people's exhaust can be your, you know, can be part of your product.
Yes. Yeah, no. Sustainability, right? Environmental friendly solutions.
So the gin company that makes their, what they call the neutral spirit that then is then distilled with the botanicals, that's part of their business identity. That's part of their labelling. We know that the younger generations are really keen on looking at sustainably sourced products, that people are producing in a sustainable way that's having reduced environmental impact. So they took bananas that were misshapen, and they used that to make neutrals cord, so it's the neutral alcohol. So therefore they're taking something that would have been waste and producing value out of that waste. They're reducing the amount of waste fruit that goes just into landfill. So, and that's part of their marketing. They're called Damaged Goods, which I think is a really cool name.
This is definitely good because there's so much wastage. Like, if you just think about it, right, a lot of people, I guess we just live our life, right, consuming without truly understanding the proportion of waste, right, that is being generated, but we don't see it because it's just not shown to us. It's always been hidden away, right, before it reaches the shelves.
Yep.
Is that fair to say?
Yes, and that's there's a lot of fruit that doesn't meet a standard or can be rejected and sent back again, and that becomes waste as well. And for the grower to try and get that perfect apple, and so they have to be hand-picked In Australia,
so no machines.
No, they are coming. They are coming. The mechanical harvesting, but you've got to plant your orchard so it can be mechanically harvested.
Yeah.
And then you've got to pay for a very, very expensive piece of machinery. But the orchards. So apple trees last at least 25. There's some 40-year-old pink lady trees out there, or you know. So there's really, really old trees out there, and those orchards were planted, you know, 25, 30 years ago, when the way of planting orchards was different to what it is now, and they're not planted for mechanical harvesting.
So, yeah.
You've got to understand agriculture, and like orchard, being an orchardist, it's a long-term business, and most of the orchardists are children and the grandchildren of original orchardists, a really big family business. But every time you buy an apple, you're not just paying the orchardists, you're not just keeping the orchard in a living, you're keeping their staff in the living, you know, keeping them in a job, you know, you're creating income for the regions where the apples come from.
Yep.
And you're actually buying something that somebody's actually put their heart and soul into growing. And a lot of the orchardists are thinking may walk away eventually because it's getting too hard. But people don't see that. They just see what the price is per kilo at Coles or at Woolworths or Farmer Jack's or whatever place you'll go to buy them, or at the farmer's market. But the best, I go down south and I pick up bags of apples when I'm down there at the harvest and give them out to my friends when I come back to Perth, because they go like, oh, these are so fabulous, because they've come, they've not been processed and they're not been sitting in storage and they're not been sitting on the Woolworths shelves. They've become straight from the grower. So
absolutely, absolutely. Whereabouts are all the growers? Are they all in Manjimup, or are they kind of spread around?
Manjimup, Donnybrook. There are. Yep. I think there's one outside of. So it was the Perth Hills. There's a cider in Perth Hills that has a whole orchard of pink ladies, but the pink lady apples. But they didn't know what to do with them, so they turned it into the cider, and now they're called the Cidery, and they've got this amazing business model. They're fabulous people. You should go and have a look at just for a business model, the way they've created different income streams into their business by, you know, either they pulled out the orchard or they actually created a product out of it, and that's what they've done, and they create a whole venue around that.
So is this the core cidery you're talking about?
Yeah.
And that's great place.
But it's a great place from the point of view. It shows what you can do if you are prepared to create different ways of making revenue. So they also have food, but they have orchard tours, they have apple picking, they have fruit picking. So all sorts of different ways to create revenue into the business. And I think this is one of the reasons I want to do the Apple Heritage and Produce Trails. Also looking about how can I get people to be selling fruit at what we call the farm gate, but how can I get other products being made so that the orchardists make the most out of the fruit that comes out of off their trees in return for the money that they put in. How can we get people interested in the apple industry? The Donnybrook Apple Festival's on Easter Saturday. It's free to go to, and you can find all about apples and all the other produce from the regions. So I think that unfortunately we've become, and again you'll find that in a lot of businesses, we become disconnected from the actual production process, and we don't understand that production process, and so we don't know the growers that grow our apples. We don't know the people that whose hens lay our eggs. We don't have that connection with the produce world, and that's actually to our detriment, and as consumers as well. So if we understood the love that went into making the apple, that it took, you know, 15, 20 years of my father's life to get that apple up and running, and same with the Bravo. So he worked for like 40 years in apple breeding. You know, that's his contribution. But if you knew that, maybe you might value the next Pink Lady apple that you buy more.
Correct.
And that's my passion for doing the Apple Heritage and Produce Trail, is to try and get people to understand where their produce comes from, and to value apples because they were an important staple. And, you know, you can get, if you're I buy little pink ladies because I like to stew them and make them into a stewed apple to have with my breakfast, but they might be $5 a kilo or $5.50 a kilo. And what did you pay for your last takeaway coffee?
Yeah. So much more than that.
Yeah. So your pink lady apple compared to a cup of coffee is actually cheaper, and it's cheaper than a chocolate bar. But we've become used to everything that's bright and shiny.
Mm.
We like things that are visually appealing. I mean, pink lady apples are visually appealing. And we like things that are fast and easy.
Convenience. You know,
and convenience.
Yeah.
But, you know, fruit, a lot of fruit has its own packaging already, you know, and it has it's nutrient rich, and it has lots of good characteristics. Pink ladies, Bravos have lots of flavonoids, which are really good for your heart and for your blood pressure. So there are health benefits to apples as well. So, I mean, we joke about an apple a day, but, you know, there are health benefits. So choose an apple rather than a chocolate bar.
I mean, to be fair, right, all jokes have a grain of truth in them. That's why they were actually made, right? Jokes. I mean, with your apple heritage, let's talk about a bit more. I think it's pretty exciting because you're right in that you have to be able to have a kind of a ability to showcase that history, right? So with this Apple Heritage project, tell us more about what you have in mind. So it's like a museum exhibition or?
It's a combination. So it would have a digital platform which we can store oral histories on.
Yes.
I'm aware that a lot of the original growers in their 80s now and the people that worked with Dada in their 70s and 80s, and one of them passed away recently in Donnybrook. So one of my goals is to get some oral histories so we can understand the history of the industry, how it affected people. There's already stores of photographs and there's different people that have those stores. There's heritage historical societies that have photographs. If you go to the cider in Donnybrook, they've got all sorts of photographs to do with the apple industry.
Yes.
So there is a lot of ephemera already. There's a lot of audio, visual. There's a couple of videos around the apple history, so we can put them online. But it's really for people that when you're traveling into the hills or into the southwest, that you can actually intersect. So the idea I had was to have posters with a QR code which will link you to the information on the website, so the oral histories or the photographs from that particular area. Mm. But also to say, okay, you may be in Pickering Brook, but over here is a cidery that uses pink lady apples. Over there is where the original research station was.
Mm.
I'm not sure the people that bought the research station really want people wandering across the research station because they're now a clothing manufacturer. But, you know, you can find out, you can within an area find out what's going on. And if you want to learn more, then particularly if you drive down the Southwest Highway down south, if you start in Donnybrook and you go down to, you know, Manjimup. There was also growing at Bridgetown. I know there's a couple of orchards still at Pemberton. A lot of the orchards have gone because it's just been too hard for people to get them growing, and the current changing climate is making it harder and harder. So they have to reticulate their orchards now, whereas before they survived on water. But the idea is that there's an online presence. There's a physical poster of some variety. We're looking at packing boxes. So we used to export apples and we had these really brightly coloured packing boxes. And how I found this out was I have a friend who lives in Sweden and they were renovating their summer house, which was an old farmhouse in Sundsvall in the middle of Sweden. And they were opening up the walls because they're so cold there. You have to have like insulation between the outside wall and the inside wall. And they found it a West Australian apple packing box. So they'd taken the wood with the poster on the side of the box and put it in the wall and had Jonathan's, and they were the fancy grade apples. And it had a black
Jonathan's.
Jonathan apples, which I haven't seen them. They were around when I was a child. And they were fancy grade. And we knew they were West Australian because they had a black swan on them. Very useful to have an icon that's only one place in one place in the world.
Yes.
So I then found out that people have been keeping these packing boxes. So there's a couple of sources of those. There's somebody up in the hills that has a whole wall of photographs of the packing box posters. So I thought they might be the theme. But I'm really good at connecting information and I'm really good at talking about things, but I really do need to write the strategy and then start looking for funding to fund the online presence and to actually get it up and running and trying to link together all the places that the apple industry has or is functioning now in Western Australia. So people say, oh, well, I'm in Manjimup. There is an exhibition about the apple, small one about the apple industry there, but then I can go down Seven Valley Road and I can visit a particular, I can't pronounce his name, but there's a guy down there that does all these different fruits, and his father was an orchardist and he's an orchardist, and and you can go and buy, you know, fresh produce, including apples. And he actually's got original Krepp's Pink Lady apples, because the original ones have less red, but we've now, the ones that we have now are actually like a variant, because they have much more red all over them. So I said, have you got original Pink Ladies? He said, yes. I said, oh, good, but they don't have enough red on them to put them on the supermarket shelf, but they're still good apples.
They taste great.
And they taste great, and I took them home and I stewed them and put them on my breakfast, you know. But that's the thing, is like they didn't meet the standard to have enough red on them, because it's trademarked. It has to have enough red flesh to meet the requirements of the trademark, or to be called a pink lady.
Yes.
In Europe, you'll see Krepp's Pinks, because they haven't made the trademark, because they're not good enough. So
I see.
But just trying to get people interested, and you know, there's all sorts of things. We're working on scavenger hunts. We're working on education for kids.
Yes.
There's all sorts of different activities we want to do. But I mean, I'm doing this as a volunteer, so. I find that, you know, sometimes I go like, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, because I'm, you know, it's not part of my job anymore. So it's not part of my job. So, but it is something that I really want to do, because I really want people to love the apple industry and love the amazing people I've met in the apple industry, like I do. And it's not about my dad, but it's about supporting WA and WA innovations, WA economy. You know, what other state in the world, what other country in the world has had 4 successful varieties of apples? I mean, it's just unheard of. I mean, New Zealand can't match us. They get a bit competitive, and Braeburn are the best. But, you know, and look, and you look at, if you go into the supermarket now, and like if you talk to your grandmother and you said, you know, where are the Golden Deliciouses and where are the Jonathans and, you know, Granny Smith is actually an Australian apple as well. Yes, it is.
Right.
Yes, it was developed. A lady threw her apple peels into a pile and a tree grew and it came out as the Granny Smith. That's where the Granny Smith came from. So,
which part of Australia is it from?
It was Eastern States.
Eastern States.
Yeah. So there is a podcast about women in apples. It's in the West Australian Library. I can find you the link and put it in the show notes if people are interested. You can learn all about the history of apples and about women in apples as well.
Yeah. So. Wow. Well, look, we'll definitely put that in, right? Okay. So please do share it. It's a great segue to the next thing I do want to ask. And of course, it feels like, you know, for sure that you have a really strong sense of pride, right? You know, with your affiliation with Pink Lady Apples and the whole story. Has it always been that way, or has there been moments where like there's been a lot of kind of overshadowing by someone who is so close to you and yet is such a big part of your life, Helen? Because the reason why I ask this just really quickly is because we work with a lot of generational family founders, right? Business owners from different industries. And every time they reach that milestone point whereby their father, right, is maybe perhaps retiring or wishes to move on, and the son is being groomed, or the girl, the woman's been groomed, daughter's been groomed, right, to take over the business. Of course, your situation's a little bit different, right? I'm just very curious, like, how does that affect?
It's been a really interesting journey, because I knew a lot about it when I was a child, a teenager, and Dad used to go away every year to England and go and promote the apple in England when we're trading there. And he got inducted in the Royal Horticultural Hall of Fame here in West Australia, and he won an Order of Australia in 2015. So there was interest in him along the way. But when he stopped working for the department, he kind of like, he was still working into his 70s, but then they didn't renew his contract, so he stopped apple breeding, and he sort of walked away from that. And he was an incredibly humble man, and he didn't like fuss and attention. I don't really like it either, but anyway, so as he got older, we just looked after him. We took care of him. He did know about the Bravo. And if you buy little Bravos, they're called Krepp's Gems. And they did that for Dad as a way of recognising Dad and his contribution. But it wasn't until my father actually passed away. So I actually went to his house and he'd passed away. I found him and that was it. And I organised everything because, you know, he was so old. We were expecting it. And my sister came up from where she lives. She lives in the country. And then we were talking and then the next morning my phone started ringing. And I'm going like, this is the radio station wants to talk to me. And I did 4 radio interviews in 48 hours for ABC and for 6PR. Different people wanted to talk about John Cripps. And I'm going, well, nobody much talked about him for the last 20 years. What's going on? And and then it became, then the international upper growers started emailing me and they people here at Pome West and people in Western Australia started emailing, sending their condolences. Because I worked for Ithaca University, I was really easy to find and I had been in contact with people previously. But this, it started to get on a roll where people kept contacting me and it came to me probably about 2 days after he died. We were organising his funeral and I realised I was not just burying my father because that was what I was prepared for. It was like, you know, he'd had a fabulous life. I'd been involved in, my sister and I were looking after him after Mum passed away and I spent a lot of time with him and I thought, well, that's it. It's come to an end now. But then suddenly his legacy sort of started looming on the horizon and people contacting me. And so like in organising his funeral, we had to find someone to speak about what he did in his job. And I put a call out and growers came from from the southwest and from the hills came to his funeral. Lots of people who had worked with him came to the funeral. So it wasn't just about me personally burying my father. It was about celebrating his legacy, celebrating what he did and acknowledging the people that were part of his life outside of his family. So that's what probably people might find if they're in a legacy business is people know their parent through the business and they know them in a business context, but they're not like a family friend, if that makes sense. They're a business friend. I don't own my father and it wasn't up to me just to say, oh, this is a family funeral. Actually, we broadcast it far and wide because I wanted people to have a chance to celebrate the man they work with, the person whose apples they grow, all these kind of things. And so it became really, really big. There was an outbreak. A lot of people was when it was open after COVID came into Western Australia. And I had 10 people say, look, we can't come because we were not well. And there were over 100 people at his funeral and he was 95. And you don't get 100 people at someone's funeral when they're 95. You know, so there were so many people that came along. So, yeah, it became that kind of legacy. I started to impress me that there was more going on here than, oh, I've buried my father. You know, John Cripps passed away and that's it.
As a father-daughter relationship.
Yes. That it was going to be something a bit bigger than that. And then my sister and I were invited to Thailand for the International Pink Lady Alliance conference and they flew us there, paid for our accommodation because they wanted to honour our father and they did this video of people all around the world thanking Dad for the Pink Lady Apple because it had then allowed their businesses to grow. So and that's what I found when I went to Italy. It was these family businesses. So the father who was... you know, most of them still work in the orchards even though they're in their 70s and 80s, had planted Pink Ladies and these families, these generations of families had made living successful from planting this apple and they all gave recognition to Dad. And I didn't realise they grow them in Japan and right at the end of this video is an absolutely fabulous piece where this guy from Japan sings a song about the Pink Lady apple. Wow. And it just really blew me away and it nearly had me in tears. And it was then I realised that, oh, I'd just been so functional about doing everything and getting on with my life that I had not grieved my father's death. And I think that's... for someone that comes into a family business or has a parent anybody when they lose their parent, it's terribly difficult. But when it's a parent has a public profile, people want to come up. People come up to me and say how much what my dad meant to them.
Yeah.
But they're saying to me and not my father. And I haven't done any of that. I've just, you know, been his daughter and, you know, shared in some of what he did. But I wasn't the person that did all that stuff. But people have made tremendous livings and again, generational impact.
Yes.
And so they want to tell me. And so I have to learn to be gracious and allow people to express that emotion to me because they have to have somewhere to express it. And, you know, I thank them for that, because it does mean something to me to know that my father has had that impact. And when my father turned 90, he was quite depressed. And I told him to cheer up, and there was another word I used in that sentence. And I don't usually with it very much, but I was told it'd be bleaked out, so I didn't say it. I told him to cheer up, and I gave him a list of reasons why he should be happy that he'd made it to 90 and that his life was fabulous. And, you know, he still had his first wife, because when he got married, he joked on behalf of his first... he said, on behalf of my first wife and I... I said, you still got yourself a first wife. So that was it. And he's got two successful children, and, you know, and he had a grandson. My sister has a son. And, you know, they lived at home until they both died. So they had, you know, fabulously good lives. But I said, Dad, I don't know anybody that's bred a variety of apple that has provided employment for thousands of people around the world. You know, and if that's a legacy of a company, that you provide employment for people, you provide a livelihood, you provide a future for other people, and that's what I saw last year, particularly when I was overseas visiting the growers, that is an amazing legacy. So I told him he should cheer up, because he had achieved amazing things in his life. He didn't really see it or acknowledge it, and I think a lot of people tend to be very humble about those sorts of things, but to me it meant a lot that... he had done something truly, truly significant, and I don't think I ever would have that bigger impact. I've had impact in my students' lives, I've had impact in my friends' lives, but the impact of what my dad did, standing out there cross-pollinating and spending his weekends and motivating others to get on that journey with the Pink Lady Apple, has had impact in so many people's lives. And I think that's worth celebrating, but it's also worth celebrating the people that continue to make the pink, to grow your Pink Lady apples, and to work 7 days a week. A lot of them, particularly during harvest time, they all work 7 days a week, and that a lot of them are still working into their 70s and 80s. You know, they don't die. They continue. They're out there. Actually, in the orchard. They don't retire. They just keep working those orchards. You know,
that's all they know, right?
That's all they know. Mm. And a lot of them were immigrant farmers that. Or they came out between the First and Second World War, or they came after the Second World War, you know, and they brought their knowledge. A lot of them are Italians, because they were growing apples back in Italy, and they brought that to Western Australia. And that, again, is something that we should celebrate. And we've had all these waves of immigration into this country, and we need to celebrate each wave and what that wave has brought. Well, thank goodness people came from other countries after the Second World War. My father was English. We had the most bland diet ever. And thank goodness that all those people came from Europe, and then all those people came from Asia.
Yes.
And, like, I just walked up the street today and there were, you know, 20 different food outlets with 20 different varieties of food. I mean, you know, our culture is so rich because of it.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. As a first generation Australian Chinese, right? Mm. Like, you know, I completely understand, you know, when my parents came across from Malaysia. Right. And then they ended up in Christmas Island. Right. And the life that they lived. Right. In order for me and my brothers to kind of be where we are today. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. It's a huge achievement.
Yeah. Huge.
I'd just like to point out that my father came as an English immigrant to Australia.
Mm.
And I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase it. So the growers, when his dad turned up to do research and work with them, they said, what is this Englishman going to teach us?
Oh, wow.
And so we always think about this, the problem of being an immigrant as being about the fact that you're not white Anglo-Saxon, but he was white Anglo-Saxon. And in the 50s, the Australian growers resented him and were resistant to him because he was seen as an outsider because he'd come from England. And they thought, you know, he's not a local. What's he going to teach us? What does he know? He's an Englishman.
Yeah.
You know, so I just wanted to point that. And it was really quite hard. And my dad was quite a gentle soul. Mm. And it was really hard. And like he met my mum and married her about 3 or 4 years after he arrived. But he was alone when he arrived here. You know, and to go out into the field and be, people say, oh, you know, and now people come up to me and say, oh, your father did this and this and this and this. And so, it, you know, it's that total contrast. And I think that's, you know, we need to celebrate, not about my father, but all these people that have, all the people have come into Australia and made Australia better. And again, the original residents of this country, the Indigenous people, we need to celebrate them. And yes, going back to the gym, Jin, we have some amazing knowledge in this country, and we need to look after this country, but also have to celebrate that knowledge. And I know that in the area of drug or pharmaceutical area, we're still going through all these amazing plants we have and working out what the pharmaceutical application of them are. And we've got nowhere with we've only done a very small proportion. There's huge opportunity there. I mean, I love Australia because there is opportunity there.
There is.
But we just need to support that, and I know the government's going to do that a bit more, but we need to say, where is the opportunity? Where can we do something different? Or in the case of the growers coming or people coming from other countries, other cultures, what can we bring from our culture that can enrich the culture here? How can we do a slightly different twist on it?
Yeah.
And I think that's what I think is really great. You know, Australian society really benefits from that. So, and we went to Chinese New Year on Monday last week, and that was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, you enjoyed that one?
Oh, it just blew me away. as a girl from Perth, that was born here and was only allowed to watch the ABC when she was growing up. I'm not joking. Well, that's the case. But
no,
I had
SBS?
No.
Not even?
Well, the SBS wasn't around. So it started off, you know, Channel 7 and Channel 9, that was about it. Channel 10 was a late to the party, but
yes.
But I was so glad that Countdown was on the ABC because I got to watch that.
Okay, great.
Sounds like I had a really deprived childhood, doesn't it?
No. Absolutely not.
What else do you want to ask?
So look, I say, like, definitely needs to be celebrated, right? The whole story and the legacy, and I think everyone comes from different origins, right? It's also important to reflect on the entire journey, not to just lord on the successes, but also the challenges, right, that one has actually gone through in the past, right? And no, thank you so much for, like, you know, being willing to share that part of your father's story as well. Just really briefly, I think a lot of people can relate. I am sure there's a lot of people listening on this podcast that can definitely relate. I mean, we are a country of immigrants.
We are.
Yeah, and it's important to know that. Yeah. So talk about celebrating, talk about next steps, right? Talk about, like, you know, what's next. So what is next for you, Helen? So what is in store for you in 2024? We only just started. It's in February now, but what's up and coming, Helen, that you can share with the viewers? And
so, as you know, I actually resigned from my permanent position at Edith Cowan last year because I felt it was time to step aside and let other people take over. And I was fortunate that I didn't actually require to work. I was in a position where I could afford not to work. And it gives me more time to chase the Pink Lady Apple Heritage and Produce Trail. But it's allowed me to explore areas that I'm really interested in, things like agritourism. So that's what the trail is. That's a really growing area, and we really need to focus on actually building that as part of Western Australia. So it's not just about let's find out about apples, but what's our local produce? What's the local food? How does our food come to us? So one of the growers down in the southwest, occasionally, if it has to be organised and paid for, but she has a couple of schools come through and they tour her packing shed. Now, she uses artificial intelligence, image recognition, to sort the apples. Now, is that cool or is that cool?
Very cool.
That is very cool. And I said, are these people all locals that work? And she said, yeah, they've worked in this packing shed for 20 to 25 years and they don't want any other job. They just want to work here because they love working here because we treat them so well. And she's taken all the mechanical labour out of packing fruit by using automation and robotics. So it's super, super cool.
Wow.
But food tourism, understanding where food comes from, agritourism, having authentic experiences in the countryside. I was talking to somebody today, you know, most Perth people think their authentic experiences, you know, a nice Airbnb and eating something from the Dunsborough Bakery. And that's not really food tourism or agritourism. But, you know, we need to make sure that we create these authentic experiences for people and people get to understand what it's like to be a member of the agricultural sector. Because originally, before we started digging stuff out of the ground, our main industry, primary industry, was agriculture. And then we rode on the sheep's back when we started as a country. Now we just ride on the back of the haulage truck or the automated train that goes to out to the
ports.
Ports, yeah. Yes. But you know, and the automated dump trucks now. Yes. I just love that. Anyway, so but we were really good at solving problems and being innovative, and a lot of the things that we developed in Australia was because of our isolation, and we had to solve those problems, and we produced unique products that were world-class standard that we used to export. I mean, wool export was huge. I mean, we are West Australia's the biggest grain producer in Australia. We do punch above our weight as a state and as a nation in agriculture. But we don't celebrate that. And unfortunately, in this state, the mining industry has skewed the economy. Mm. And that is a little unfortunate. I wish we would mine more data and mine less minerals. That would be that's my tag term, really, because I'd love to see people understand about data mining and give young people new jobs. There's new careers that haven't come through yet. And I think that's really, really important. And I think we also have to celebrate diversity, not just culturally, but neurodiversity and the different ways that people do things. You know, because you read my notes I sent with the script, I'm actually dyslexic and it's probably only been in the last couple of years I've been able, competent enough to say that, because I was back in the 80s sacked from my first job at a bank because I couldn't add up as fast as a teller because I was dyslexic. So they said, either you resign or we'll sack you. And I was so ashamed that I was dyslexic that I actually resigned. I now have 4 university degrees, including a PhD.
Amazing.
And that's why, and going back to talking about the students, that's why I'm so driven, is because I had great family backing.
Yes.
I had great family support. I had well-educated parents. I went to a private girls' school, and that's where the dyslexia was picked up. So, but I met students at Edith Cowan or whatever university I taught at that didn't have that framework, that didn't have that scaffolding. So if I could help them through, if I could support them, you know, oftentimes I would hunt down students if they didn't put their assignments in. Not that sounds terrible, hunt them down. But I would actually contact them and they'd say, you're the first lecturer I've ever had that's contacted me about
no
that.
No one reaches out.
No, but I would reach out. Yeah. I mean, I had a student last year that he missed an assessment, and then I said, are you going to do the next one? And he said, oh, we emigrated this year. I'm an international student. We've been living in a hostel. I couldn't find somewhere to stay. Mm. I've dropped out. I said, you dropped out of one of your subjects already. I said, but I don't want you to lose this one.
Mm.
And so we worked together, and he got through, and he was very, very thankful for that, you know. And quite often people will come up to me when they've come through graduation and come up to me and talk to me at graduation or introduce me to their parents and say what an influence I had been in their journey. And I'm happy for that, because then they're successful. They've finished their degree. That's given them more opportunities. Mm. I want people to have opportunities. I want people to do new and interesting and inspiring things, you know. I want people to have enjoyable lives and careers and build families and or travel or do what they want to do. And if they don't have the scaffolding, then sometimes those people fall through the cracks and they're a great loss to society. And if I hadn't had the scaffolding, I would never have made it to particularly getting a PhD, and I never would have ended up in the classroom to influence those people, you know. No, Dad had a lot of support, and he had my wonderful mother, and she made his life quite easy. She had dinner on the table at 7 o'clock every night. Just shout out to Verity Cribbs. You know, she was, you know, fabulous. I just didn't inherit any of her culinary skills, unfortunately. cooking something that's really not on my agenda. But anyway, I do wrestle with it occasionally. But, you know, that's my passion, is to really to help people, because if we help people that face difficulties, obstacles, and they overcome them, then they go on and do things that might not benefit us directly, but, you know, and they go on and have great lives, and they have great kids, and those kids, you know, they get jobs or they come back to university or whatever.
Circle of life.
And it creates that kind of
ongoing.
But if we don't help and support people, then, and they fall through the cracks, then that doesn't go on. You don't have that rolling momentum. And I think that's really important, that generational momentum. I personally don't have any children, but my sister has a son and he's doing his PhD in marine biology, and I'm really, really proud of him for that. And when he first turned up in Perth, because he was living in the country to start his degree, he struggled a lot with starting university, coming out of a different environment. So I gave him a lot of support. He used to wander down the corridor and I would help him. I knew nothing about marine biology, but I would help him write his, help him with his study skills. And so, yeah, and now he's completing a PhD and I'm so super excited for him. And he's going to help us manage our marine assets because, you know, again, the climate is changing. So
it is. It is.
But it's a generational legacy that benefits everybody.
Definitely does. Yeah. Definitely does. Well, it looks like, you know, Helen, I think you and I can go on and on talking. We have so much to talk about, right? Yeah. I reckon we will definitely get you back next time for a second episode because you did a really great, great run this time around. So thank you so much for
I'm
that.
I'm supposed to ask you questions. What's for you in 2024?
Well, I mean, 2024 is the year of the wood dragon, right? So that's incidentally my zodiac, right? Mm-hmm. So now everyone knows how old I am. If you can do the maths, do you know how it works? The zodiac maths?
Is it 10 years or
12 years?
12 years. Oh, okay. Because I thought that, because I'm 60 this year, so I thought I was actually born in the year of the dragon.
So you would be
64?
Yeah, I think you'd be, you're not the dragon, but another animal. You find it pretty quickly if you find it online.
All right, we'll look that up.
Yeah, we'll look that up.
We'll chop this out of the podcast.
It's all good.
We can look it up.
It's all good. So this year is really big. So obviously, we have a lot going on at the moment. We do a lot of work right across the country, right? So we have an office here, Perth, and also in Sydney. So the team is growing quite well. I'm happy to say that, you know, the digital marketing, branding, design team is the strongest that we've ever had to date, and that's thanks to a lot of our supporters, not just clients, but also individuals like yourself, Helen, right, who support on a variety of ways, like, you know, allowing us to kind of get that in reach into the academic education sector, as well as being able to connect with the students and also understand, like, you know, the type of caliber that's coming out of such institutions as well, which is really important because the students, the young ones, are the next generation.
That's right. They are the next generation.
They are.
So when you, in running your business, when have you, when has it been the most difficult? What are the challenges you faced? Because you're a business owner, so I think you're really brave. I'm not a business owner. I've always worked for a salary. So, you know, what are the biggest challenges you've faced as a business owner?
Biggest challenges I face? How long do you have? Like, you know,
maybe we should, you know, maybe I can come back and interview you next time. But, you know,
yes.
I think one of the things I think about you, Cheech, is that you're always very positive. You're always willing to give. And you're always, you've never, I know things have been challenging, but you've never actually shown that. And you've always looked for solutions. And I think that's a really key thing that, and you've reached out for support to other people. So I think that for people who are business owners, that you need to be positive and to be optimistic. You have to be realistic about the bottom line. But I think it's really important to build that business network and the people that can come alongside and can mentor you and just give you support or give you just cheer you up when things are really, really bad or send you clients. And I think that's really important. Again, that whole networking thing is don't go looking to get something. Give first before you ask.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's really, really important. But I think that's I think that people also resonate with you because you are positive and that you are encouraging and you are interested in other people. You always ask me about myself before I get a chance to ask you about you. And I'll get, okay, I have to answer that question. but I think that's a really important trait for business owners to have is to be genuinely and you generally care about the welfare of your staff, and I think that's really important too, and that's how you maintain staff. We're always looking like, oh, we have to be competitive, we have to be super, you know, this, that, and the other. But I think like we have to be people, and everybody is a person, and you know, we've got to take into account that people have ups and downs, and you know, people lose family members and things like that. But I think that we've got to value people, build into other people's and people, and they'll lift us up and help us to be successful. That's my way.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You heard it from Helen. Like, you know, that is the way. And I think it's a very beautiful way. Right. Mm. So no, most definitely. I completely agree. You have to be optimistic. Right, in business, like, you know, but you have to be optimistically pragmatic.
Yes.
That is the key word, right? Okay. If you're just completely optimistic without really understanding the calculation, right, of the risk reward, of the cost of benefit, right, then that's kind of where you might get into a little bit of a bit of a pickle. Mm. So a lot of ups and downs, right? I mean, I can't share all of it now. I will definitely share it next time, but I will share one quick one.
Yep.
And that's actually when I started, right? So this is a story where when I started the company, right? This was September 1st, right? 2014, okay? So that's when I actually started Ignite Search, which is the digital marketing company that you and I are collaborating on. So I'm not sure if you remember, but that's a very interesting inflection point, that 2014, 2015 period in the WA economy. Do you know what was happening with the economy at that time? So you know how we had the really big mining boom?
Yep.
Right? That started for 2008, 2009.
Yeah, so it was coming off the boom then. Because we had the GFC, but we didn't really have the GFC in West Australia.
No, we did not.
But then we actually had it. Then all the projects have been ramped up. Yeah. So there was no... So we were coming down off the other side of that. So we were going into a slight... I don't think we ever used the word recession in Western Australia, but, you know, they're more of a downturn.
Yeah, definitely a downturn. So when I started my company, right, I kid you not, everyone around me, right, everyone, so many friends, they were saying, Cheech, you're like so crazy. Like, this is maybe like start of 2015, right, January, February, March, when all the news started to happen, when the slowdown was being more visible. Top line visible, meaning in the media, right, but hasn't really hit any bottom line yet. It hasn't hit me for sure at that time. But they were always starting to question, like, Cheech, you are crazy, you're insane. Like, you know, what are you doing? You study a business when the mining is clearly tapering off, right? And I mean, if I was any lesser soul, right, I probably would have given up, right? To be fair, like, you know, it's actually quite depressing to see all this like negative talk around you. And you know what they say, nature versus nurture, right? So that kind of nature, the people around you, right, that does affect you. I mean, hard to say that it doesn't, right? But what's important was that I knew my own conviction, my own position, my own justification for starting the business, right? I mean, I actually left on very good terms with my former employers, right? It's just that I had a different vision, right? I had a different philosophy on how I thought I could actually improve things, how I could achieve and transform company visions into results, right? Which is what we do now. So I wasn't worried at all. And straight through from there, right? From day one, in fact, when I started my company, right? I was already revenue positive.
That's fabulous.
Right? And I would say that's as a result of, you know, doing what you do well, right? The results and the outcomes are number one. You know, being a very... a person of your words, right? Being very kind, being very supportive, right? And in the end, you are working with people, right? You look at all these companies, like, it's like, oh, big company A, big company C, right? And then when you're outside of it and you look outside, oh, it's so great, you're working with this big company, it must be fantastic, right? It's not really the company that you're working with.
You're working with people.
Yeah, you're working with people within that company. And truth be told, those people may or may not be there forever. And they might actually even move to different companies, right? So what you're really building is you're actually building relationships with the individuals within the company so that it doesn't matter where they go, right? They'll be able to actually always bring you along for the journey.
Perth is an incredibly small city, even though it's got 2 million people in it.
Yes.
I very... very often go out somewhere and bump into somebody I know.
Yes.
So I'll be with a friends or something like that, and I'll say, oh, there's so-and-so. They know I know so-and-so. And it's just that kind of city where it's not 6 degrees of separation. It's about 2.
Even that, I would say, sometimes.
Yeah, it's 1 or that. You know, you bump into people all the time that you know.
Pretty much.
And I think that's really important. And it's about keeping those relationships positive and fresh. But I remember when you first approached ECU about teaching, you had that confidence. And I think that confidence is really important. I've struggled to have that confidence. And I think for people that struggle with confidence, it's good to have other people that believe in you. there's a lady called Sheryl Sandberg that said women should, there's this thing about leaning in when she had a nanny and all the rest of it. I wanted to start a women's organisation called SHOVE. So the other women, so I've seen it a few times. It's happened to me, much to my surprise.
Yes.
If somebody said, oh, let me introduce you to Helen, who has all these amazing things going on. And I'm going like, okay, I was just standing here listening quietly, pretending to be invisible.
And now
you're pushing me forward. And I really think that if I can get women or people in general to push other people forward and push them into opportunities where they've got the skills and expertise. And I think that would be absolutely fabulous if we could do that. So, and SHOVE is probably, that's a very Australian word, but you know, that we push, give other people opportunities, or we say, well, look, I'm not suited for that, but hey, look, I've got this friend over here that's suited to that. And they would be, you know, maybe you should talk to them and they could actually help you out. And I think that's a really important thing, as, and particularly if you're like, I find I'm not particularly, I've got more confidence as I got older, but I wasn't terribly confident when I was young. But having people around me that believed in me, like I call them my cheer squad, you know, and I think that's really important. And as a
your
person,
tribe.
Your tribe and your cheer squad. But also I always find it's really good to cheer on other people's successes, and I think that's really good for us to do that for each other. And sometimes in Australia we can be a bit cynical and we can chop the tall poppy down, we can cut them off, whereas we should be saying, that's really great. Good on you. And if you can do that, I can do that too. If you can succeed in that area, I can succeed in that area too.
Yeah.
So I'm going to cheer you on when you win an award and or when you do really well at something. And we can cheer each other on and support each other and create opportunities for each other. And I think Perth business would really benefit from that, but all businesses would benefit from that. So I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. And I guess this is my objectives and what I do want to achieve as part of this podcast, to actually be able to bring out these stories like yours, like other people that, you know, people might not be aware of, right? That they'll be intensely interested in. So look, we have run out of time, right? I most definitely will. No, it's great. No, I love it. I love it. I definitely want you back on if you're willing, right, for another.
I am willing.
Fantastic.
You just have to work around my travel schedule, because you asked me what I was doing this year. I'm going back to Europe and I'm going to learn more about agritourism.
Yes.
I'm going to visit the growers again.
Yes.
And I'm doing stuff so I can learn more, so I can help to build this Apple Heritage and Produce Trail, and I can support the industry and I can support the people that grow the Pink Lady apples that still keep me attached to my dad.
Of course, of course. We most definitely want to hear more about all of that. Now, before we leave, can you share a bit with the audience how they can actually contact you, find out more about you? Yes.
Okay, so I'm on LinkedIn, and that's where I post. I actually now post a lot about my apple journeys on LinkedIn.
Fantastic.
And I try and highlight the industry there. Also on Instagram, that's personal, but that's kind of almost like random. But when I travel, my Instagram is actually really worthwhile. Yeah, it's quite following.
We'll throw that in.
I'm working on my Instagram game.
Yes.
I haven't got to TikTok. I do have a TikTok account, but I haven't got to TikTok. But I think TikTok's the next big thing.
Okay.
Particularly I was talking to the Apple industry, and there's a couple of guys in Italy and saying, you need to get into TikTok. We need to get into TikTok to promote apples, you know.
Yeah,
because that's getting to the young people, and they're going to be the choosers. But yeah, LinkedIn
and Instagram.
Instagram's more humorous. I make fun of myself a lot. Okay. Humor is very much part of my life.
No, most definitely.
And so, but yeah,
great.
And I'm actually quite easy to find. So, and I still have not at the moment, but I do actually. I'm still adjunct at Edith Cowan University. So I'm pretty easy to find on the web.
Beautiful. That is really great. Thank you so much again, Helen. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Cheech.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much, guys, and I'll see you in the next episode.